Hello, legends and listeners, and welcome back to the Monday Big Football Show, the Athletics Daily podcast dedicated to Big Ten football. This is Scott Dockerman, and I cover Iowa football. Nicole Auerbach had to step away today, so filling in for our five-star national college football writer is our own five-star recruiting czar and Ohio State writer, Ari Wasserman. It's kind of like we have our own Ohio State roster here at The Athletic, where we're filling five stars with five stars. Ari, welcome to the podcast, man.
Yeah, I don't think I could replace Nicole, but as a five-star talent myself, I can come in and make sure there's no gaping hole for the time being until she gets back.
Yeah, just if you're going to make mistakes, man, just do it at full speed.
That's what I am. I will make mistakes, and I absolutely will do it at full speed, so you don't have to worry about that, and my athleticism's off the charts, and you know, that's the good thing about this podcast. If one of us is not around for a show, or you plug somebody in and you still go win the football game, and, you know, stars matter. That's my life motto.
Stars matter. Well, out here at Iowa, sometimes they don't, but it's one of the rarities in college football, I think. But, well, stars certainly mattered in Columbus over the weekend, and in the Big Ten's version of Showdown Saturday. It kind of seems like both the East and West are settled now, Ari. I mean, I guess let's start with Ohio State, Indiana. 35-7 in the third quarter. I think anybody who bet on the Buckeyes was feeling pretty good at that point. Then the Hoosiers came back and made it a contest. What's kind of your impression of what happened and at the Horseshoe?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting game because on one hand, anybody who watched it for the most part, at least through three and a half quarters, saw a legitimate top five team playing another top 10 team that might not actually be a top 10 team. And the difference in talent between the two rosters was evident. And you had the 35-7 score. Ohio State was scoring at will. And, you know, it almost seemed like it was about to be one of those 55-14, 55-17 type games. And that's what I thought it was going to be. But Ohio State has some holes in their secondary and some things that need to be cleaned up in Indiana, a tough team that believes in itself and wasn't going to give up, took advantage of those holes. And, you know, I don't know if the final score says more about Ohio State's ability to win a national title or more about what Indiana is as a team right now. I think it's kind of a little bit of both. I came into the weekend thinking that Ohio State was the favorite to win the national title, and now I'm not so sure that's the case anymore. And I came into the weekend thinking that Indiana was fake good because they didn't play anybody yet. And, you know, they had some guys and they had a talented quarterback and Tom Allen's a good coach, but I wasn't necessarily sure that this was going to be an exciting game. And it turned out that Indiana was a lot better and a lot tougher than I gave them credit for. So I think it's an interesting dynamic because now Ohio State goes on to a schedule that doesn't really have very many tests. And by very many, I mean zero. I mean, what do they have? Illinois, Michigan State, and then Michigan. And we'll get to that later. It doesn't seem like they're in a position to, you know, lose a game. And you know, Indiana, meanwhile, might be a top 10 team in the college football playoff rankings. I think they earned that. I don't know that they're a legitimate top 10 team, but given the fact that they've, you know, beaten Penn State, Michigan, and Michigan State, and now really have one more test at Wisconsin in a few weeks, there's a possibility that they could finish the season with one loss. So I think that the talent gap was evident. I think if you watched it, you see what talent means to the sport. But on the other hand, Indiana is a tougher team and a more competent team than maybe I gave him credit for.
You know, when I watched Indiana when they had Kevin Wilson, I mean, he could do a lot of different things offensively, and they were always very competitive. They just never really seemed to get over the top because you just didn't see that togetherness. And I'm not going to go into the love each other stuff that, you know, Nicole absolutely loves. But that's, to me, I think it is evident, though. You saw the heart, the tenacity, the toughness. I mean, any team that's in that. Now, there wasn't 105,000 people, which is a very intimidating environment. You know, out in this part of the world, we call it the Death Star, you know, Ohio Stadium. So there wasn't that kind of environment. But still, against that team to be down like that, most teams just fade away. We've seen it. I think, remember a few years ago, I think it was with Michigan State that had a pretty good, if I remember right, maybe they beat Penn State and then they came to Ohio State and got crushed or something to that effect. And but for the Buckeyes, in some ways, is this like the perfect situation to win a game, get exposed by winning against a pretty good team to know that, okay, we're serious. If we want to go win the national title, you know, they're operating with their thoughts on Trevor Lawrence and Mac Jones. Is this the kind of the area that you'd say, okay, we've got to get better here, and we did it, but we won, and we beat a good team doing it?
The best case scenario for any college team is to be exposed without paying the consequence of losing. And a lot of times, Ohio State in the past hasn't adjusted as much as it's needed to because they didn't lose, and only after losses, you might remember one of them.
Yes.
It takes a lot to change things. That means changing coordinators, changing personnel, changing scheme. Ohio State has changed quite a bit in the past after program-altering losses, but I'm not necessarily sure that being exposed kind of without losing has led to the changes necessary that will save a season. And, you know, I don't know if it's the as easy as switching some guys around in the secondary or what it is, but Ohio State absolutely needs to find an answer in their secondary. And, you know, as fun as it is to sit here and talk about how tough and gritty and Indiana is, that's not Bama.
Yeah.
That's not Clemson. And that's the team that Ohio State seems like it's going to face if it can get past Northwestern in the Big Ten championship game, and I suspect that they will. And if they have this type of defensive situation when they're playing against Trevor Lawrence, they're going to give up 50 points. Now, I don't know in modern-day college football if that's as glaring of an issue as it's been in the past. Nick Saban said something interesting this past week, and I agree with him. He said, I think the days are over where you're winning a national championship by playing elite-level defense. If you don't have an offense that can score into the 50 points against anybody, or a team that can put up 40 points against anybody, then you're not winning a national championship. And the good news for Ohio State, despite the fact that I think they do have some deficiencies at running back, is that they have an offense that can score 40 points against anybody in college football. And that gives them an opportunity to potentially win at the highest level, but you don't want to go in and let these first-round draft pick quarterbacks, I mean, even Kyle Trask would tear that up. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to have to be put in a situation where you have to win a football game 51-49.
Yeah, and I mean, this, I think I've noticed with the secondary there that the big problem is not having Chase Young from last year. I mean, he was able just to ruin games, which enabled the, you know, to really mask some of the deficiencies in the secondary. And, you know, now, you know, even with, you know, Sean Wade opting back in was a help, but, you know, he could get better. And you look at Michael Penix, I mean, 491 passing yards. That was just unreal for that guy to be able to put that up. Now, granted, Ohio State did a great job of stopping the run, but Penix was just otherworldly in some ways. And, you know, but when we look at the other side of the ball with Justin Fields, you know, three interceptions, he was my runaway number one Heisman guy last week. But after what I saw yesterday, I'm waffling a little bit more than I thought I would. What do you think? I mean, does this take the complete air out of it, or does it just bring him back to the pack, or does he have a chance here with a couple more games to really return back to the leader's position?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I hadn't really pondered it. Because after the first drive, I think he was like 4-for-4 with a touchdown, and he had more touchdowns on the season than incompletions, and that was like a thing that was happening on Saturday. That was the worst game of his college career at Ohio State, at least, and Ohio State still was up 35-7 in the midst of it. So I think that gives you a nice little warm feeling if you're an Ohio State fan. But on the individual award spectrum, I think that, you know, that one game, and considering the fact that it came against a quasi top 10 team, I don't think he's going to have another opportunity to play as well as he needs to on a large scale to get people's attention back. So I don't know if he lost the trophy. I don't know what the stats are going to look like at the end of the year. Maybe this will all fade together if Indiana loses a game or two more or whatever the case may be. I think he lost some steam in my ballot. I don't know that it's over yet, but you know, you don't want to see your quarterback who's, what, thrown 3 or 4 interceptions his entire career come out and throw them all in one game.
Right.
And he'd have the worst game of his career when Ohio State needed a statement game, I guess, at noon against Indiana, as weird as that is to say in 2020. Mm. So, you know, this Heisman is kind of a weird scenario because you have games being canceled. It's like Trevor Lawrence at one point was the runaway favorite, and then he missed a few games because he's out now because he missed a few games because of COVID. It's like a really hard, you know, as a voter myself, it's just a hard thing to kind of wrap your mind around in terms of how to rank these. How do we do stats here, Scott? Like, is it just per game stats? Is it total cumulative stats? Like, I don't even know how to approach it.
I mean, I'm really looking at it almost by the eye test exclusively because, you know, back in the day, you know, even a few years ago, you had Lamar Jackson that went crazy with statistics. And you're like, these are otherworldly. How do I even decipher this and against some other players, Dwayne Haskins or whomever? But then I guess I look at, you know, what's the South going to look like in the Heisman voting with Trevor Lawrence and Kyle Trask and possibly Mac Jones. Well, Mac Jones certainly is in there. You've got Justin Fields. He kind of comes down. You know, Breece Hall is, to me, kind of one of those guys that's sneaky, playing for the best Iowa State team Iowa State's ever had. Out West, you got Zach Wilson, but it's BYU. This would have been the perfect year for, let's say, if Chase Young was back, or even Sewell from Oregon, if he hadn't opted out, or somebody like that, that you could say, you know what, I don't know who to pick out of all these quarterbacks because the stats are crazy and different everywhere. Maybe I'll just go with that guy. You know, this could have been that defensive year, but there's just nobody out there that defensively you just go, yeah, that guy's the best player in the country, unquestioned.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, I think the eye test is going to be a very important factor to all these things, not just Justin Fields, but the playoff committee as well. And, you know, you're just going to have to judge by who you think is the best. And, you know, Justin Fields had the stats in terms of completion to interception ratio coming into the game. And, you know, when you watch him play, for the most part, he seems to be on a whole nother level of the rest of the team. He makes things look so easy. But also in a world where you're kind of walking a tightrope on your way to the Heisman voting, you can't have a game like that. So how it's going to – I'm very interested to see how the athletic straw poll is going to shape up after this weekend. And, you know, depending on how things are going, you know, Trask might take the lead now, or, you know, it's kind of a – every day is a different type of scenario. So,
you know, when I look at what we got next with Ohio State and Indiana, and then we'll move on to the next big game, and that is, you know, Ohio State plays Illinois, which doesn't have the passing game to beat the Buckeyes or really even threaten them, but they do smack the taste out of your mouth. I mean, they are a hard-hitting team, and that will be something that they'll have to catch up to a little bit. And then, you know, you've got the end against Michigan, which Michigan's kind of a train wreck, but, you know, do they have one great performance left in it? And, you know, and what's the other one? The one in the middle there after
For Ohio State?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let me just try to remember off the top of my head. They have Michigan State again.
Michigan State.
On the road to Michigan State.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the Michigan State of yore, so that's not going to be much of an
Ohio
issue.
Ohio State's going to be favored by 28 or more for the rest of the games that they're playing.
Exactly. Isn't that going to be crazy for the final against Michigan? You'd at least think that there would be a challenge, but I don't see it right now.
And you have to remember, too, that there was an incident in the summer where Jim Harbaugh was implying that Ryan Day was cheating in recruiting, so I can tell you from firsthand knowledge that he's pretty amped up to score as many points as he possibly can on that team.
So like another game that I saw a week ago where somebody, you know, was up 28 points in the fourth quarter and still went for two. You think that would happen in this case too, huh?
I think he was he said that he wants to score 100 points.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's going to happen or not, or if it's just off-season, you know, jibber-jabber. But I know for a fact that he's highly motivated to make the score look as uncomfortably even as possible for Michigan, or uneven as possible for Michigan.
Okay. Well, on the other side of the conference, there was another division deciding game with Northwest pulling a 17-7, in some cases, shocker against Wisconsin. And it's kind of interesting because every time the Wildcats beat the Badgers, it kind of surprises us. But from 2000 onward, I want to say Northwestern is 8-7 against Wisconsin. And certainly I know they're 6-1 in Evanston. You know, I guess, did you expect this type of game or result? And are the Wildcats better than the fighting Reese Davises, as one OSU alum alleged earlier this week?
You know, I was very – I know you said – made the comment that we're shocked every single time this happens, and I'm shocked again. And I don't know if it's because I felt like Wisconsin – in Northwestern series, like, didn't tell the story. My whole viewpoint, and I've said it on every big football show we've been on, every time I'm on Andy's show, and every time we discuss Wisconsin on the Ohio State podcast, I was hoping and I thought that Wisconsin was going to be a different version of itself this year.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, they've had some COVID issues, obviously, and have missed games, and But I thought when they had a top 100 player at quarterback leading the way and running the show, that that would imply that this team was playing at a higher level, you know, or playing at a level high enough to maybe potentially not just push Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game, but maybe win. Mm-hmm. Because my recruiting philosophy is that if you land a top 100 player at quarterback and that quarterback actually is a hit and plays at an NFL draft type level, then that's like the equivalent of having five or six hits at other positions. So to me, my opinion of Wisconsin was very high this year. I know that they beat up Michigan pretty good last Saturday, and it seemed like they were an whole otherworldly team. And I guess we found out a little bit on Saturday as we get more and more context moving through the schedule that Wisconsin's beating down of Michigan was more of a red flag about where Michigan is as a team right now than it is about Wisconsin's dominance. And now you've got to flip the page and you've got Northwestern, who's 5-0. And when they are having seasons like this, Pat Fitzgerald does a really good job of keeping them afloat and maintaining that success. And now if you look at the remaining three games that they have in their schedule, it looks like the Big Ten might be decided here, you know, barring anything weird. Northwestern as an undefeated representative from the Big Ten West, and Ohio State is the undefeated representative from the Big Ten East. I thought, and going into the day on Saturday, we thought that that would be the reverse in terms of Wisconsin being there. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that it's funny to me how well that Northwestern can kind of overcome the Stars situation. I know it's – I was listening to the Bear podcast from ESPN this week, and he said, I bet you the average person couldn't name three players on Northwestern's offense. And I guess, like, you get past Bowser and Ramsey, it's like who could answer those questions? Not very many people, but still they're in a position now where they're going to run through the Big Ten during a very odd year, and it's just like Pat Fitzgerald is a really good freaking coach, man. And there's no other way to say it. This team is legit. Wisconsin couldn't get anything they wanted on either side of the ball. And it was just, in my opinion, despite the fact that it was just a 17-7 score with a bunch of punts and a bunch of, you know, defensive stands, that Northwestern proved to be every bit as legit as possible. And if I'm, you know, a playoff committee member, I put them in the top 10 because when you're 5-0 in a season like this, you deserve that ability to have that ranking until you lose it. And with Ohio State game inevitably coming down the pike, this is kind of when you have your opportunity to show that you belong there. But until then, they belong there because they've earned it.
They remind me an awful lot of the 2015 Iowa team that went undefeated during the regular season but didn't really, quote-unquote, play anybody. And all they did was beat teams and beat teams decisively. That's the same thing here. I mean, I saw Northwestern come to Kinnick, and they were down 17-0 in the second quarter and fought their way to a 21-20 win. And what they did to Graham Mertz, they did exactly to Spencer Petras, young quarterback, making his first big start. Three interceptions for Mertz, three interceptions for Petras. You could look at those teams and go, you know, Wisconsin and Iowa are more talented than Northwestern. They still made it happen. And part of that is, even last year when they were 1-8 in the league, they played high-level defense. But their offense was just putrid. They had nothing on offense. And so you couldn't just leave those guys out there for 40 minutes because you're going three and out every single possession. And that's pretty much what they did. But they have the two best linebackers in the league, in my opinion, and Blake Gallagher and Patty Fisher. They had 27 tackles, each forced a fumble yesterday. You know, they also forced five turnovers, two fumbles and three interceptions. And, you know, kept Wisconsin down on third down. Because even though the Wildcats only ran for 24 yards, they were able to, you know, they just stopped them. I mean, Wisconsin got into Northwestern territory seven times, and they scored a total of once. So there were a couple of PIs on defense. Just, you know, they really got Wisconsin out of sorts. And that's the thing Northwestern does so well. They're so disciplined. They're tough. They play good defense. They take advantage of your mistakes. And Peyton Ramsey is a difference maker. He reminds me of Dan Persa going back 10 years ago. Just a great player and has put them in a position where nobody can catch them. Anybody behind them that's of any value, whether it's Wisconsin, Iowa, Purdue, they've all lost to Northwestern in very close games.
So where would you put them? Where would you rank them in the playoff situation?
I would rank them probably about 6 or 7. I think that they are And it's because, yeah, they don't blow your socks off. They don't have that game-breaking offensive player. I still think they need to prove it again, you know, and that's probably against Ohio State. If they run the table and beat Ohio State, they deserve to be in. They played their way in. Can they get there? You know, I don't know. I mean, I think they would have to play the game of their lives. I think they're capable of that. I think Peyton Ramsey's capable of making plays, just like he did at Indiana before he came there. They've got some tough running backs who are committed, and the defense is legit. But, you know, do I look at them and say, man, that's a playoff team. They got to be there. Not quite. But I think they got an opportunity to play their way into that, in that threshold if they win out.
Yeah, well, there's no way that an undefeated Big Ten champion, regardless of who it is, whether it's the Big Bad Buckeyes or Northwestern, that they would get to the playoff. And, like, that would be their first game. And it's just, like, that's kind of the unfortunate reality. Whether you're Northwestern, whether you're Wisconsin, whether you're Iowa, from the Big Ten West, which actually, and ironically enough, is better than the Big Ten East for the first time, still has a date with the Ohio State Buckeyes in the Big Ten Championship game. And I think there's a certain ceiling for these programs, because until you can beat that team, all the things that you do on the way to the Big Ten Championship game, unless you're fortunate enough to, you know, be in a situation where it's one of those weird years where Ohio State doesn't make it, you know, you have to be able to athletically step up and beat that team. And Wisconsin had Ohio State on the ropes last year in Indianapolis, and there was a chance, and it kind of felt like Wisconsin had an actual chance to win that football game. But lo and behold, after halftime came out, Ohio State came out and won, and not only won, but beat them up bad enough to cover the original spread. And it was just, it's just a tough team to match up for fourth quarters athletically. And, you know, I just, like, would love to see Northwestern's, and we're going to get to see Northwestern's defense match up with Ohio State's offense. Because I think that, like, if you want to see how good this football team is, you know, that's kind of where you're going to get to see it. And the one thing I'll say about Pat Fitzgerald, and I mentioned this on Andy Staples' show this weekend, was that I feel like nobody has brought their team in the Big Ten to the ceiling of their program more so and more often than Pat Fitzgerald. And the ceiling of their program is Big Ten championship game and potentially, you know, pushing Ohio State for a few quarters. I don't know that their ceiling should be expected as a playoff berth or a national championship. I think that's irrational. I think what's rational is running through their division in the Big Ten West, winning games like this against Wisconsin, other teams that are good and very solid, but also athletically challenged, and then getting to a point where they can compete or at least play with the big bad teams of the college football playoff discussion, and the one of which they get to see quite often is Ohio State. And they've done that, what, now? Is this their third time doing this under Pat Fitzgerald in the last 10 years? I mean, it's a pretty remarkable coaching job that man's doing.
It is. No question about it. I mean, you know, he's, you know, I've seen every single time they've come to Kinnick, and he's 6-3 at Kinnick Stadium. And, you know, six of his wins against Iowa, he was at least a 6-point or greater underdog. So he's found a way to win some of those games that he's not expected to win. He's matched up evenly with a Wisconsin and Iowa, you know, Michigan State is their protected crossover. Programs that have seemingly a little bit higher profile, yet he's able to win at least half of those games, if not more. So it's really impressive. He does have the defense that I think can frustrate the Buckeyes. I think that when you look at you know, the way they steal the ball, and I mean, again, in their two biggest wins, they have a combined 6 interceptions. So they can cause some problems for Justin Fields. They have great linebackers, not necessarily great pass rushers, but I think they got pass rushers who can cause some issues. So, you know, maybe force Fields to try to throw the ball down the field and make mistakes. I don't know that they have the offense to keep up for four quarters, but I think they have a good enough team to where they'll fight. And so I guess if this was a non-COVID year, would you tell Buckeyes and Wildcat fans just go ahead and book the trip to Indy?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I don't think anybody's going to beat Ohio State, because I just don't know that there's going to be a 30-point underdog upset. Like, I know that Minnesota's kind of a tricky team. Mm-hmm. Minnesota played really well on Friday night, despite the fact that they – I don't know if we're going to get to that, but
yeah.
That was the worst gambling finish and referee call I've ever seen in my entire life, and I'm not exaggerating. Mm-hmm. But they're still a tricky team on offense, and that's a road game, and it's probably going to be frigidly cold at that point. But I do think that I would book my ticket.
Yeah, I think it would too, especially because you don't have to fly if you're, you know, in the Evanston area. You could just drive a couple of hours and you're right there. But and same thing, I guess, with the Buckeye fans. But, you know, we did have four other games over the weekend, and I'm kind of grateful that we could get to this point in the podcast and not talk, you know, and finally get up with the Harbaugh discussion, really. But Michigan, for, you know, down 17-0 to beat Rutgers, I don't think I've ever seen a team flatline like that. And then you turn the page to Cade McNamara. What does this mean for the program this year? Does this mean anything? Even though that, yeah, they looked like they played hard. They were able to squeeze out a win against Rutgers. That's not the Rutgers from last year, but it's still Rutgers. What do we make out of this?
I'm just so past this. I just, like, every week it's the same. And I don't know, like, I think it's clear that Michigan's football program needs a change of leadership. And I think the fans would agree with that. I think anybody who's watching this, I know it's a bad year for Michigan, but they should never be in a position where they fall this far. And I'm not even talking about the Rutgers game. I'm just talking about the way that the team plays, the way that they have been all season, and just kind of like the hopeless nature in which watching them has been like. And yeah, they won, but I think that's almost worse than losing. Playing a game for four quarters and some overtime periods where you look like you deserve to lose is worse for the program than it is than just embracing the dumpster fire of the season and hoping for a change that can bring you out of it. So I don't know if there's going to be a change. I think there's a big difference between the administration wanting and needing a change and what fans and reporters think is the scenario. And it doesn't seem right now that there's a huge groundswell from the administration at Michigan to want to make a change. But, you know, at one point people were accepting the fact that Michigan was going to be a 9 or 10 win team every year that can't beat Ohio State, which I thought was a problem. And now it took the bottom completely falling out for them to get to this point. And, you know, when you look at, you know, the biggest fear for Michigan fans in general is we don't want to be in a position where we're the Brady Hoke years again or the 3-9 Rich Rod year. And it's just like, guys, we're there, you know. And if you're there at Michigan, what is it? Is it the recruiting problem? Is it a coaching problem? Is it a culture problem? I mean, there's a major problem here. And even when Michigan is down, they should lose four games maybe in the season. They shouldn't be struggling every single time they play a team that they beat 52-0 a year ago. And granted, I know that Rutgers is a more improved program. They're not the most awful team in America the way they've been the last 3 or 4 years. So that's part of it. But there's no reason why the gap between those two teams could have closed so much where Michigan needed overtime and a missed field goal in overtime to win this football game. And, you know, that's that. It's as plain as day to me.
Okay. Well, we'll let the Mitten State guys on Thursday take care of more of the Harbaugh talk, and we'll move on a little bit. Iowa, you know, pounded Penn State, 41-21. Sean Clifford didn't start, came in, actually gave him a spark with a couple of touchdowns, and then Davion Nixon had one of the most electrifying defensive big man touchdowns I've ever seen, because the guy weighs 305 pounds. He is legitimately a athlete and a half for Iowa, and he had a 71-yard interception return where he kind of did a Euro step in the middle of the return. And but more than that, I mean, Iowa's won. It's after losing to Purdue by 4 and Northwestern by 1, Iowa's won its last three against Michigan State, Minnesota, and now Penn State by a combined 90 points. The running game is at a different level than it's been in a long time. It's efficient. It's good. It's physical. The defense has really played more than solid. I mean, it's been outstanding at times. I guess for Iowa, it's a little too little too late when it comes to the division. But, you know, what does this mean for the team, the program, even, you know, maybe a crossover matchup potentially with Indiana, say, in mid-December?
Yeah, I think that what's tough for Iowa with the fact that they've been playing outstanding the last 3 weeks is, like, if you go back and you think about it, they had that 17-point lead against Northwestern. They were in the game with Purdue the entire time. And, like, now, all of a sudden, Iowa, if you played those games again, I think might win. I think if you played the Northwestern game next Saturday, I might pick Iowa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a testament to the team that they have. And, you know, after a weird 0-2 start, it could have gone the other way and it went the right way. So, you know, hats off to Ferentz for doing that and getting it back on track. But man, they've been impressive. I mean, I'll let you talk about Iowa. You're the guy, but I've been impressed by them. And now it's the hallmark win for Northwestern as it tries to prop itself up as a playoff contender.
Right. I mean, I think it's fascinating when you look at Iowa in the greater context of what it had to deal with during the summer, with, you know, 60 plus right. players coming out, you know, discussing, you know, racial disparities and bias in the program. The strength coach, who was kind of the heartbeat of the program in some ways, was you know, left. And you kind of wondered, okay, is all this going to catch up with Iowa? Then you throw COVID into it. Iowa's a team that always needs like that first game against a MAC team to kind of shake off those, you know, those problems that they are, that, you know, to get going in the right way. They didn't have that. And at Purdue, they had 100 yards in penalties, which was just uncharacteristic, two critical fumbles. But so they were at that 0-2 crossroads where you're thinking, after the offseason they had, after these two close losses, one of their better players gets an OWI the next, well, about 10 hours later, you're thinking, okay, this thing's cashed. And instead, here they go. You know, they put it all together. So I guess, you know, Ferentz wins Big Ten game number 100, fourth all-time in Big Ten history. And they're looking as good as any team in the league. And I think you juxtapose that with Penn State. 0-5 for the first time in history. Started out as a number 8 team in the country. Looked at it probably as, if we can at least be decent against Ohio State and win the rest, maybe you're there in playoff contention. Now, what? You know, 0-5. They look below average in a lot of areas. They don't look as bad as 0-5 normally looks, but they're 0-5. I mean, what do we say about James Franklin and Penn State at this point?
I think what we say is there's 3 more weeks left in the season, Scott, and, you know, get out of the season as quickly as possible and hope that was a blip on the radar more than it is an indication of the direction of the program. And I think it probably is. You know, even though their 2021 recruiting class is a dumpster fire for Penn State standards, it's still, you know, there's testimony there. They've proven over the course of the past 5-6 years that they can be the second toughest out in the Big Ten, and I anticipate that they still will be. And when you think about Penn State, everything that could go wrong for this team going into the season, losing Micah Parsons, losing Journey Brown, losing these guys to opt-outs and medical issues, it just hasn't been a good year, and sometimes bad, disastrous years happen. I'm surprised that, you know, they're 0-5. You know, if you told me they would have lost to, you know, Nebraska, Maryland, and Indiana before the year, I would have been like, oh, my God. this is an oh, my God scenario. But, like, if you look at it, all three of Michigan State, Penn State, and Michigan in the Big Ten East, programs that usually made the Big Ten East one of the toughest divisions in college football, are all terribly down. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's part of the reason why I think Ohio State walks into the playoff, because they're not necessarily challenged. So, you know, Iowa was an underdog somehow in this game, maybe because it was on the road. I don't know why. But, you know, it just kind of seems to me now that the Big Ten West has more meat on the bone in terms of dangerous teams than the Big Ten East. And it took a lot of these teams being down, but here we are.
It's interesting because, you know, people who watch it really closely could understand why Iowa won that game. You know, and whether it's you're covering Penn State or you're covering Iowa or the Big Ten as a whole. But then everybody kind of going at 20,000 feet will say, oh, well, Penn State won't go 0-5. They can't go 0-5. Well, you know, it's not like on the field, you know, Sean Clifford or Will Levis is out there going, hey, we're 0-4. We're going to make sure we win this game. I mean, you got to play the game on the field. And so I'm kind of there with you when it comes to Penn State, where, you know, this is just a bad year. It happens in the NFL a lot like this, which is you get a schedule that a lot of times the good teams play the good teams in week one and the bad teams play the bad teams. And then all of a sudden you get a good team who starts off like 0-2. And then it's like, oh, now what? And when you have those injuries compiled with losing by an inch or a fraction of an inch at Indiana, and then you play Ohio State in week two, they're 0-2. Everything they're playing for is gone. They sleepwalk through the Maryland game. And then it just kind of spirals out of control. I think this is a situation where James Franklin can recalibrate the program. I have no doubt that he will. This is just a year you kind of write off and say, it's bad. I think they can win still a couple of games left on their schedule. But, you know, a team that's kind of similar to Penn State in a lot of ways historically and is Nebraska. And Nebraska is kind of trapped in this, you know, Michigan slash Penn State mold where you bring back the golden boy in Scott Frost. But he, you know, hey, a couple of years in here, I'm not so sure he's the answer. When you get beat 41-23 by Illinois and they rush for almost 300 yards on you, I'm out of answers for the Huskers. I don't think that it's easy. I think that they've almost got to face themselves as this isn't the 90s anymore.
Yeah, well, I think they've done a really good job of that, actually. And I think a lot of programs, you know, doing this recruiting writing venture, you know, don't know who they are. And I can see it in the comments and people get bent out of shape. And Nebraska has done a really good job of recalibrating itself from top five team every year in the 90s to maybe a top 30 program. And, you know, they've recruited in the top 25 every year and they should be a top 25 team. But now it's like, do you have to recalibrate back to top 50 program? Because I don't like know what the answer is here. And, you know, I know that it was exciting and, you know, a lot of these home run hires from guys who are supposed to be the savior of the program come in and do the thing that they need to do to get it back. And it just doesn't work. You know, there aren't a lot of Nick Sabans are out there that who just come and are a slam dunk hire and do everything that you think they're supposed to do. Is the same thing that's happening in Michigan with Jim Harbaugh now. He was the homegrown Michigan man who came in and has fallen flat on his face, frankly. So I think that Nebraska might be the most tortured fan base in America because they can't have anything, and it's kind of a tough thing for them. But at the same time, too, it's just like, is Scott Frost the problem or is the program the problem? And the situation of where it is geographically in terms of how it can accumulate talent and, you know, all the things that, you know, it takes to make a really good football program. And, you know, I get that it still should be beating Illinois. It should still be beating Illinois. It shouldn't be getting blown off the field by Illinois. So maybe that is a coaching problem. I don't know. I just like, to me, Michigan always says, if you get rid of Harbaugh, who are you going to get? And I think that that's a funny thing because there's 15 names I would take right now. Mm-hmm. At Nebraska, I don't know what the answer is there. If it's not Scott Frost, then who there?
Yeah, that is a great question because when you got a base like this that expects so much more than it's been provided, you know, who wants to walk in that situation that already wasn't a part of it before? And Scott Frost, you know, people would follow him anywhere, but after losing these games and really, you know, they've struggled against, they've lost seven straight to Wisconsin, five straight to Iowa. But I think in some ways they don't have to aspire to be Wisconsin or Iowa or Northwestern, but they need to look at those programs as the keys to success because you're not going to out recruit the Eastern teams. They just, their profile and their location kill them in that regard. So what they need to do is look at where is it that they're getting blown off. And that's the line of scrimmage. And if you're allowing 285 yards rushing to Illinois and the same thing every year to Iowa and Wisconsin, then that's what you need to do. And so far they haven't done it. Now, maybe they're trying and it's just not working. I don't know, but that seems to be it. And finally, as you referenced earlier, you know, on a Friday night game in cold Minnesota, probably the worst offensive PI call I've ever seen on Payne Durham for Purdue. And Jeff Brohm, to his credit, I watched his news conference. He was mad. He bit his tongue to try to avoid that $10,000 fine. But, man, that's something where the league needs to come out and either say that it was wrong or say why they made that call, because I didn't see it, not in that stage of the game anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know that the receiver made – did they even touch the defensive back?
It was kind of like an arm bar, but it was just like there was no push off. I mean, this is something that is innocent in Big Ten basketball, you know, as opposed to anything in a football game. It was nothing in my eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially like it happened so early in the route, mm-hmm. that it wasn't even, I mean, they were just running. I think it honestly, have seen some really bad calls, and you know, every single time you see a terrible one, it's the worst one you've ever seen. The New Orleans Saints pass interference, mm-hmm. no call was the worst penalty non-call I've ever seen. This is one of the worst penalties I've ever seen in my entire life. And it cost the team a game.
Yeah. And can you imagine if this was in a higher profile game? I'm not saying that there's a, you know, Purdue didn't deserve to lose. Purdue should have won. But if this was a Saturday's game where we saw a couple of really early bad calls, I thought the fumble that wasn't called, it turned out to be kind of a nothing footnote early on. You know, an Indiana receiver fumbled and it wasn't called. In the Illinois-Nebraska game, there was a forward pass. It was like a lateral that wasn't reviewed. So there's been some really crazy calls. But if this would have happened in a game that had divisional, you know, either one of the two games yesterday, I can't imagine what everybody would have been saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I covered some pretty high-profile calls and no calls. And, of course, the one in the Fiesta Bowl last year, in the playoff game, Ohio State-Clemson, the catch, strip, fumble, no call review is one of them that stands out to me. But, like, yeah, it's one thing, too, to have a terrible phantom call in the second or third quarter and let teams recover from them. But that ended the game. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's maybe it didn't. I don't know. Maybe you'd say, well, they threw a pick on the next play and that was the end of the game. And they still had a chance to score. But I think you just are so demoralized from something like that in that moment that it's just really hard to overcome.
Yeah, just ask St. Louis Cardinal fans from the 1980s about Don Denkinger's call and what that might have done the next day. So, or the next handful of minutes, for that matter. But
yeah.
Well, this is fun talking to you, Ari. I haven't had a chance to do that, you know, in this type of setting. And I always enjoy your podcast with Jesse Temple, our Wisconsin writer, on Fridays. And, you know, I guess this week you might have to go a little early or at least drop it a little early because we had a noon kickoff game on Black Friday.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm going shopping with my girlfriend on Black Friday, but, you know, I'll be checking in on the cell phone a little bit. And, yeah, and everybody, if we don't talk to you till after, I think the schedule's the same. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And, Scott, it was awesome hanging out with you.
Yeah, you too. And I wouldn't be caught dead in a shopping center on Friday. But
I am. Yeah, I'm ready to go. I'm trying to find a flat-screen TV for $17.
Well, okay, I got you on that one. Don't forget, everyone, to listen tomorrow, Tuesday, as Bill Landis and Audrey Snyder break down the Big Ten East. And all, as always, we want to thank you, our legends and listeners, for spending some time with us and adding us to your podcast rotation. So please subscribe, rate, and review us 5 stars, just like Ari's favorite prospects. Thanks, everyone, and have a wonderful day.